Could you tell me something about your new book, Not Only Women Bleed?
It shows my entire career, covers my life, really. It's really an autobiography, but I wrote it in like a style of vignettes. So if you go to anywhere in the book, click on something, because the title intrigued you or whatever, on that chapter, and just read that, and then back up or go forward. I mean, you can read from anywhere. You don't have to start at the front. But
that's great. No, I'm looking forward
cool
to it.
It's cool at the front, too, so, you know, just go ahead and start there.
I'm looking forward to it. And you, in recent years, had done production of a band, I had heard, Wednesday or something?
Wednesday, yeah.
Yeah.
Wednesday's she was a young jazz singer from New England, who I produced a record for, and tried to combine some of her jazz sensibilities with rock, you know, and I ended up calling the Torch Rock. And she was like a torch singer, and so I just combined it. It's Torch Rock by Wednesday.
Great.
And I think you'll like that album. It's a great album. It really turned out nice.
Excellent. And
we were right on the edge of being in the nomination for 9 Grammys.
Huh.
We were just on the level, just below where they're making decisions on who to put on the list. They take like 5 artists and they choose, and then they get to be on the ballot. So we were just under the ballot in 9 categories. So just with a little edge there, we could have been, you know, nominated for 9 Grammys.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Great.
Unfortunately, we weren't, but, you know, that's how it goes.
Exactly. There's politics in that, too. Yeah.
Yeah, oh, many, many, many politics.
Right.
So maybe next time, next record, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know?
And you also...
I'm working on myself, and, you know, and I'm working on possibly putting a thing together for the future with Steve Leonard. And so I'm busy. It's been great. I just made a deal for this tour in Canada and the Midwest for the summer, so I'm going to be working all summer.
Oh, great. And who's playing with
you? I'm going to Italy in February, late February to do a producing album over there on a group.
Great.
And I'm just going over there for like 2 or 3 weeks.
Very nice.
With this Italian band called Mugshots. And then I'll be back and getting ready to go out on the road this year. So.
Excellent.
Plus, I've been writing. Like I said, I've got these 2 film projects that I hope they get their final financing on it. It's really hard. The film business is really difficult right now.
Why is that?
Getting funding.
Oh, just in terms of getting funding.
It's getting funding, yeah. It's incredibly difficult. You know, so. Anyway, but they're good ideas. It's going to be good films.
Yeah, you sound like you're quite busy. That's great. A lot of things
busy.
On the...
Very busy.
Excellent. You also played on Welcome to My Nightmare. That's with the number 2 on a few tracks.
Right.
Something to Remember Me By.
I played on one track, and I wrote the song on another.
Something
There's
to
a
remember.
Song there called Something to Remember Me By.
An underture, I think.
Which is in the underture I played guitar on.
Great. Yeah.
So I got a little piece of the Alice Cooper album.
Yeah.
That's good, because it was me and Alice Cooper who conceived of the first one.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that later on.
So I was glad to be able to be part of it, you know, because that was during the period where I couldn't really play. So anyway, it's all unfolding and it's all getting better.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. You hail from Iowa originally, right? But grew up in Saginaw, Michigan area?
I was born in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
And my folks moved to Michigan when I was about 11. So I grew up in Michigan, in Pontiac, in Royal Oak, also, you know, suburbs of Detroit. And then I ended up moving to Saginaw when I was 21.
Yeah.
And I spent most of my music career operating out of Saginaw.
Yeah, and your early band, the Boss Men, was quite popular in the Detroit area. And I was going to ask this, why is Michigan such a fertile ground for great rock and roll musicians and just musicians in general? I mean, you know, Mark Farner, Alice Cooper, I think, Glenn Frey, Michigan, you know, I could go on and on. Bob Seger, Motown artist. It's pretty incredible.
You know, it's a very fertile part. Well, it's partly because these kids, you know, grow up in Michigan with just some basic fundamental values, and they're also, at least it used to be, that they were in families that were middle-class, blue-collar workers. You know, it wasn't like Simi Valley or whatever. It was very hardcore kind of stuff. And so the kids grow up in that, and, you know, rock and roll just became an integral part of the everyday life.
Yeah.
And then with the, you know, in Detroit, I mean, it's a rough town, always has been, but the bands were loud, and, you know, but it ended up being very good bands.
Yes.
It's hard to say, you know, it's in the blood in Michigan.
Yeah.
It just is.
Yeah, it
and
is.
I grew up there, and I could feel it. It's a very interesting question, though. Why in Michigan?
Well, just an incredible... you played with Mark Farner in the Boss Men, is that true? Early band?
Mark Farner, yeah, it was my band, Mark Farner.
Right.
Played with me.
Yeah, exactly.
Every year.
Yeah.
Last year of the band, Mark Farner was my rhythm guitar player, yeah.
No, I interviewed him a while ago, and he seemed like a very nice man. But,
I love Mark Farner. He's the nicest guy in the world. I produced his first solo album. We used to play together a lot. I used to write together a lot. He basically used to come around when he was 15, and I mentored him sort of in terms of songwriting. You know, and so the first song he wrote was Mean Mistreater.
Oh yeah, sure, yes.
You know, that was it. But yeah, I think he wrote that at my apartment.
Wow.
In Saginaw. It was during that era when he was 15 and 16 that I brought him into the band because he left. He left that group, Terry Knight.
Terry Knight in a pack, right.
He came with me, but then he went back to those guys ended up as Grand Funk Railroad.
Yeah.
So we've been friends, and I was sort of his mentor, and he was my band together for a while. And I went to New York City and was with them when they played Shea Stadium. It was like immense.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe it that Mark Farner, my little friend who was in my band, was suddenly playing the Shea Stadium. It was like unbelievable.
Yeah.
But I love Mark. I think he's a real talent and a great voice.
Oh yeah, great.
And a really good man. So
yeah, sure.
I got a chance to interview him.
Oh, he was a pleasure. He's very, very nice. His wife too.
Yeah.
Nice people.
Yeah. Yeah, very nice people.
Yeah. You recorded at Detroit's famed, is it pronounced the Grandy Ballroom or Grand Ballroom? And
the Grandy Ballroom.
Right. And what made it such a special venue?
Well, first of all, it's an old Art Deco kind of, it no longer is. I don't know if they tore it down or they're about to. It's pretty rough now, but at that time it was, you know, an old, classically Art Deco kind of ballroom, and, you know, with no seating, just for dancing. I guess historically it was, you know, a really hot spot in Detroit, even back in the 30s and stuff, for ballroom dancing. But Russ Gibb, this guy who's a teacher, but he was a DJ on the air too, saw what was going on in San Francisco, and he said, I want to do that in Detroit. He came back to Detroit. He rented or purchased the Grandy Ballroom and opened it up with, you know, San Francisco-style, you know, light shows and live rock bands, and opened up a venue for Detroit, and it just was a huge success.
And did multiple bands play there? Like the Fillmore here? Like a few on the bill?
Yeah, we'd have two or three bands, but some nights it was just two or just one, depending on who it was. But everybody passed through. The Grandy Ballroom was like one of the places on the map where if you tour in the United States, you play the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit. So all the big names came through there, you know.
Oh, great. Yeah.
pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. And my band, The Frost, I mean, The Bossman played there a couple of times, and then I went to and formed The Frost, and The Bossman broke up. So one of the things that we started playing was the Granny Bottom. So we were part of the initial building of that Detroit music scene. You know, I had a big influence in it, and happily so. It was great. But we used to open. We did our own shows. I mean, we had big shows with just The Frost, but we also opened for, like, Pink Floyd played there. We opened for Janis Joplin. She opened there. Oh, God, who else? Mountain.
Great.
Who came to? I'm just thinking back. There were so many people. Jimmy Page, when it was the Yardbirds.
With the Yardbirds, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it was just before they did Led Zeppelin. And, and then the, I think Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker was nice played there too. Cream,
yeah, wow.
Great. They did a show there. But the Grandy was like the place in the Midwest. It was like the rock and roll center of the universe.
That's great.
It really helped, you know, have a platform for all the Detroit bands, like the MC5 and Canadian Stooges and The Frost and Bob Seger and Detroiter,
Detroit Wills, yeah.
All the early but really historic bands all played the Granny Ballroom. And there's a great movie coming out. It's a documentary called Louder Than Love. And it's a documentary about the Granny Ballroom.
Oh, great!
And I've got three songs in the movie, including the song that plays under the credits as you roll up at the end of the film.
And these old
new
tracks?
New
songs, yeah.
No, it's a new song I just wrote called Motor City Music, and it's a tribute to the music of Detroit, so it's perfect for the film.
Oh,
and,
great.
We're releasing a video of it within the next couple of weeks.
Oh, look for that. YouTube.
Motor City Music. It's quite good.
No, that sounds great. Yeah. You were in a band in 1972 period, Ursa Major, which...
Absolutely.
Yeah, which I think is a hugely underrated release.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really a cult kind of record. It's...
Yeah.
You know, very, it was a very influential record in terms of style and,
yes,
and all of that. But it never got any kind of mainstream. You know, it did become a huge record. You know, but that's the way of life. You know.
And you guys,
do you like it? Have you heard it?
Yeah, yeah, I've heard a few tracks. In My Darkest Hour, Lay Me Down. I think
right.
I have the titles right. I heard it the other day, and it was a trio, right? That you were in, Greg.
It was a trio.
Yeah.
Greg Arama, who was with Ted Nugent in the Amboy Dukes.
Yes.
And Rick Mangone, who was one of the great drummers who never made it.
Incredible.
He ended up being a history teacher in Brooklyn in high school. So, and then it was me. And the original incarnation, when we first got together, was me and Rick Mangone on drums and Billy Joel on keyboards.
Really?
Billy was playing bass with the left hand.
Uh-huh.
So, it was going to be, it wasn't going to be called Ursa Major. At that time, it was going to be called World War III.
Okay.
That was our manager's idea to call the band World War III. and my opening date was going to be Madison Square Garden.
All right.
I don't know how he ever planned to finance that. That was his dream. Anyway, he ended up going on and managing Billy Joel and lots of other people. He's a huge agent in the business. But I had to end up because Billy left the trio and he was having problems with his wife. So he left her and moved to the West Coast, and I brought in Greg Arama to play bass. So we reverted back to kind of being just a guitar, bass, drums trio.
Yes.
And we did that first album for RCA Records and toured with Alice Cooper and with Jeff Beck, Beck Bogart and Embassy during that
period. Oh, great band, yeah.
So we did a couple of big tours, and then we broke up. So Ursa Major wasn't around long, but it's a great record.
It definitely is. Did that lead to your relationship with Alice, playing on, you know, of Muscle Love, Billion Dollar Babies, and later Welcome to My Nightmare.
Well,
Close
I first
to
met Alice. I first met Alice in Detroit. You know, we did a show with Alice Cooper before he was big, and I had the Frost. We were the biggest. We were the headliner. And Alice and I met there at one gig, and then they called me to come in and write with him for Billion Dollar Babies. And he and I wrote I Love the Dead, which was
yes
the song they ended up using as the finale song on their Billion Dollar Babies tours. And after that, I did some session work for him on a couple albums, and then I got together with him, and we wrote the Welcome to My Nightmare theme. And Only Women Bleed. And all those things.
Oh, great
so,
stuff.
So I was with him for like five more albums. And then,
yeah, Alice Cooper Goes to Hell, Lace and Whiskey, From the Inside. Had you written Only Women Bleed previously in your career, or was that, I had read?
I did. I wrote the music for it in 1968 while I was still with the Frost.
Oh, okay.
But I was never able to come up with a good enough lyric, so I put it aside. Yeah, the Frost was doing the heavier stuff anyway, so. But there it was, and one day I played it for Alice, and he said, man, I love that. He said, I hate the lyrics. I said, I do too. So we went in the house, 20 minutes later we came out with Only Women Bleed.
Oh, it's such a classic. I mean, and it's really it really deals with the issue of domestic abuse, right? Is that the...
That's what it is, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
It's been misinterpreted in the past, but yeah.
Well, when you hear Only Women Bleed, what's the first thing you think of?
Exactly, yeah.
But if you ever get into the lyrics, and actually, you know, listen to the song.
Oh, definitely.
Instead of react, you listen to it, you hear what it's about.
For sure. Yes.
It's a classic. I mean, it's been recorded by 25 artists.
Oh, definitely. And I Never Cry was another gigantic, that might have been a bigger song in terms of sales or not?
I Never Cry was the biggest selling one of all.
Right.
You know, it sold like 2 million singles.
How did ballads come out of such a rocker, you know? Just beautiful, really touching ballads, man. Fantastic.
Well, you know, that's me. I have a romantic heart, I guess.
Yeah. Great.
And I'm really good with writing ballads. And so that's just what came up.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain songwriting, but it's just a natural thing. You sit down and you create yourself a mood, and then you start thinking.
Does music come first? Right. Does music come first, few lyrics, or does that switch?
It really depends. It depends, honestly. It can go any way. They can come at the same time, or the lyrics can come first. You can write a whole bunch of lyrics and then make songs around them. Or you can sit and just come up with, you know, music, melodies.
Yeah.
And work words into them. So it can go either way. Anyway, I've written songs from every direction.
Oh, yeah. I've read, you know, who you've worked with, been involved with is just incredible. So many different people. Air Supply.
Thank you.
Yeah, real, very talented. Do you consider yourself a guitarist or a songwriter or both?
Both.
Yeah, both, of course.
I mean, I am both. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Definitely. You and Steve Hunter were co-guitarists, of course, and that was Cooper's band, Lou Reed Band.
Right.
You've had an amazing musical relationship. Is it also a personal one?
Well, we're friends. I mean, we're not like close buddies. We don't hang out together, but we do when we're, you know, playing out on the road together. But... You know, Steve is Steve and I'm me, and it just happens that when we actually play guitar together, it works.
It meshes incredibly, just amazing, really.
Well, we both know how to, you know, leave room for the other guy and listen to the other guy, you know, instead of trying to steal it all.
Right.
Nobody needs to be the best. They need to play music together, so that's our way of thinking.
Yeah, that's a good point. The leave space, yeah. I mean, your intro on Sweet Chain on Rock and Roll Animal and the solo section on Train Kept Rolling, those are quite legendary. Did you guys spend a lot of time constructing those solos? I mean, how?
Not at all. No, not at all. Those are all improvised.
Wow. That's just amazing to think. Yeah, both were improvised.
But it was amazing to do it. I'll tell you that. Inspiration. You know, you get really inspired, and you never know what's going to come out.
Exactly.
Sometimes it's beyond what you would imagine if you were trying to write it.
Right, it's just naturally.
Take all the memory you have of every guitar lick you ever played, and you start getting into a flow, and things start coming out that are new and different. So, you know, it's, you just have to be there and do it. It's nothing you can really describe.
Yeah.
I mean, there are no words for it. It's just a moment in time when you're feeling correct with yourself and the band sounds fabulous and you're just enjoying the music while you play it. You know, those kind of things happen. So that's true of those records the same way.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, I heard an L.A. Forum show of you with the Alice Cooper Band, Welcome to My Nightmare Tour. It was just incredible how you two guys play off of each other, mesh. It's just amazing. Guitar work.
I know, it is amazing. We're going to do it again.
I love it. Yeah. It's great.
We're making plans.
Excellent.
We're thinking about it, and I think it's going to happen maybe this year. Maybe not to the first of next year. I'm not really sure because of schedules. But we will do it again.
Great.
We'll go out. Do you think people will come out and see us?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's worth doing, definitely. I was going to ask you, playing on Train Kept Rolling or playing on Destroyer, how did that come about? I mean,
Bob Ezrin. I mean, he's the producer. And,
sure.
And he always called on either me or Steve or the two of us, you know, to come in and do projects. We were his go-to guys, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He needed guitar players. If there was a band in there that wasn't cutting it with guitars, bingo, he'd be calling us.
Wow.
You know, that's what happened with Kiss and Aerosmith and all of it. We were just more experienced players and so on, so it made it easier and, in the end, probably better. But,
yeah.
Like Joe Perry and guys like that, they eventually got better and better and they didn't need us. But at a certain point there, they needed us.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those are such signature sounds that will, you know, go in rock and roll history forever. Fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree with you, and I hate to say it. I hate to sound egotistical, but you're right.
Well,
they're classics. They're classics.
Yeah, well, definitely. Who are some early, I mean, this is getting way back a little bit, but who are some early guitar influences that you had?
B.B. King, John Williams, Link Wray, Duane Eddy, early people.
Great.
You know, Eric Clapton when he first came around with Cream, that was an influence. Jimi Hendrix, of course.
Yeah.
You know, the greatest of all times.
Yeah, he influenced everyone. Yeah.
Just the greatest. You know, those players were great players that I grew up with. And I was close to being the same age, so we were all part of the same kind of era. And I learned really fast, so I got in there with them at a pretty early age, really. And, you know, and part of that history.
Right.
I feel fortunate.
Yeah, it's great to be part of that, yes.
Ideas.
What makes a great guitarist, do you think? I mean, I play, but is it precision, speed, is it feel, is it tone, is it just all of it together?
Speed has nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Precision, of course, does. I mean,
yes.
Learning to play in a pocket and learning how to beat, you know, just a little bit behind the beat so it sounds soulful and especially the touch on the guitar. I mean,
yes,
you could play the same notes by 50 different guitar players, but the one who has the right touch is going to make it sound musical. And it's important that it becomes music and not just guitar playing. because it's easy to get caught up in just wailing away on the guitar but have it mean nothing.
That's right.
You know, so you've got to get the right touch, get the right attitude in terms of interpreting the music and what you're doing, and it'll come out a lot better than you thought it would.
Right, and should there be dynamic?
Being a good guitar, to answer your question, to be a good guitar player requires all of that. It requires a certain discipline. It's a very difficult instrument. The guitar is considered to be the most difficult. And it really is, to play it, you know, in a masterful way. It's really hard. It's also such a tremendously rewarding instrument.
Oh, definitely.
If you know what I'm saying.
Yes. No, very, very true.
How long have you been playing?
Oh, a while. You know, I have a Les Paul custom actually signed by Les Paul. I had met him here in New York City before he passed away. He would play the Iridium, you know, once a week.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah.
Tuesday nights.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, I'm still struggling with it, but I'll get there someday, you know. I have an acoustic.
Of course you will.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the right attitude. As difficult as it is, just emulate the things you hear. Try to copy them and let that influence your playing, and then eventually it comes out as your own style.
Oh, an original style. Right.
Takes a while. Yeah.
That's true. Yes. Very, very true. What about in terms of soloing? Is it, you were talking about the solos to Rock and Roll Animal. Is it all improvised? Or there must be some construction of a solo?
Well, there can be. I don't say that there isn't, but in particular, those solos that were played on those records are improvised on the spot, you know, playing.
Right.
But you have to still understand what structure you're playing within. You know, if you've got 16 bars to play, and you know the song is doing a certain kind of melody, a certain kind of thing, you try to adapt something that fits in with the melody of the song. You're always trying to enhance the song, not just play a solo.
Yeah.
Trying to do something musical, so.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's kind of preconceived, but the actual playing of it, you just go where you need to go. Like I said, it's really hard to explain.
No, that's a great answer, though. Fantastic answer. Yeah.
Thanks.
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry. You can go.
I don't know what I was going to say. I was going to say something.
Okay,
don't worry. Go ahead, Steve.
So, in terms of your amazing talent, I mean, do you consider yourself a guitar mercenary in a way? Like you had mentioned, being called to play on this or that, and of course you're in established bands, but a guitar mercenary is someone who is just at call to make a record better than it would be normally.
Well, that's what I would hope to do when I get called, is to make it better. I mean, that is my job when I get hired. Is to do something that makes it better, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
I wouldn't want to go there and do something that makes it worse.
That's true.
So that's basically what you are. I mean, I guess they call me a gunslinger.
Yeah, that's, you know, the word I was looking for, a gunslinger, yeah.
We were gunslingers.
That's a good...
It's a nice word, it's very colorful. But really, you're just a musician.
A musician, exactly.
That's make it more musical, and that's all it really is.
Yeah. What's your opinion of the music business today in terms of downloading, you know, do you think albums as we know it or CDs will disappear? I mean,
I think they're disappearing, but they're a long way from being totally disappeared.
Exactly.
You know, but I think downloading is, the more people get computer savvy, the more that's going to happen. But it's interesting how many people don't know what they're doing at all, because all these people who want to buy my book, a lot of them can't even figure out how to download them, how to get an online reader, so you don't have to go out and buy a Kindle. You can read it on your computer, and it's free.
Okay.
But yeah. They still get baffled. It's like, well, so how am I supposed to do this? People are slow, but that's okay. As long as they get to it, get it done in the end.
Yeah. And I ask most people I interview who do play the guitar, if you had to categorize top five classic rock guitarists, who would you put in that list? And, you know, excluding yourself, of course.
What would be a top five? Well, I would say Steve Hunter is one of them. I would say that Jimi Hendrix, Jimmy Page.
Mm-hmm.
I love Gary Moore.
Oh, great, yeah.
Definitely. Jeff Beck.
Oh, fantastic.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, he's like a chameleon,
and
Jeff.
And one of my favorites was Roy Buchanan.
A very underrated guitarist. I mean, extremely.
Never got the real shot. He's a great guitarist. He's dead now.
Yeah, that was horrible. He took his own life. Fantastic guitarist. Very soulful. Beautiful sound.
Wonderful player.
And I've asked this.
But those are like top five. I mean, I made a list one day of guitar players, and it's so long. There's so many great players.
That's true.
You know, somebody asked me to make a list on Facebook, so I did. And, you know, everybody's got their own ideas, too. So it really depends on who affects you at a certain time, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.